fairness, we are going to have a conversation this evening about LC 4258, the 51001 version. This looks a little different than the version you might have seen last week in that it does a couple of things. It makes some changes and modifications to the prospective piece, which was in the version last week, and then it also adds the retroactive piece as well into this version. So that's essentially what we've got in front of us today for discussion purposes. I think a couple of people have signed up on the sign-up sheet, and so we'll start by bringing some of those folks forward to talk for a few moments, and then we'll have a general discussion at the committee level of the retroactive piece and just get some committee feedback. So I would ask that we start out with Mr. Robert Liberty, a Thousand Friends of Oregon, who is for, against, and neutral on the bill. So we appreciate that clarification.
Robert Liberty, Director of 1,000 Friends of Oregon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Yes, we are for, against, and neutral. Depends on the parts of the bill and the elements we're discussing. What I want to do is touch on primarily some issues relating to the retrospective provisions, and then a few comments about subjects already testified on last week, the prospective provisions, if those will be helpful. There are a lot of things in this bill, retrospective piece and prospective piece, we like, some things we don't like, some things we have concerns about. Hence, I've signed myself as for, against, and neutral. We haven't been participating in the discussions on the legislation, but we've always understood that the retrospective piece would focus on those landowners who are not able to build a house because of Goal 3, the Farmland Protection Goal, adopted in 75, Senate Bill 101, passed as a companion to Senate Bill 100, or Goal 4, the Forest Lands Conservation Goal. Those were the situations featured in the campaign in favor of passage of Measure 7, people who could not build a house. One other thing, Mr. Chairman, I want to be clear about who I'm testifying on behalf of. I'm on the steering committee for the Oregon Community Protection Coalition, but I'm testifying today not on their behalf, but only on behalf of 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We understood that the bill would focus on people who could not build houses because of Goal 3, Goal 4, Senate Bill 101. We're not at all comfortable with the idea of paying people who plan to subdivide farmland or subdivide forest land. I think you're brave to consider facing the prospect of making payments to landowners or timber companies for not being able to subdivide land in the past, and to take taxpayers' money and write a check for those purposes. I mean, the farmland and forest land still supply raw materials that are important to rural communities. Now we're going to say, looking back 25 years, we're going to pay people for not having developed those lands. I think that's going to surprise some people. I think taxpayers and voters can understand and be sympathetic with the lost opportunity to build a house, but not lost profits on land use speculation from a quarter century ago.
I guess, Mr. Liberty, if you don't mind, I'd like to engage you on that.
Oh, that's fine.
On that concept, just for a moment. Why wouldn't the public, if they believe that a person who didn't have their opportunity to build a home on a piece of property, and therefore lost value because of that inability, not feel the same way about someone who had a right to potentially develop their property by putting more than one house on it, and lost the same right as a result of Oregon's adoption of certain land use planning laws? Why would the sympathies, frankly, be any different?
They are different, Mr. Chairman, and that's why the campaign featured people who couldn't build houses, because it's one thing for someone to have a house for themselves. It's another thing to make money by being a developer of farm and forest land. And I don't think people are very sympathetic in the latter case. I don't think the campaign in favor of Measure 7 accidentally featured people who couldn't build a house as opposed to people who couldn't subdivide.
Well, if I can, Mr. Roberts.
Well, I think part of it is because people imagine themselves in that situation, they wanted to build their own house. I think it's harder for them to be in the situation of someone who wanted to do a subdivision development.
Well, let me back up, though, and take another run, because I'm interested in just sort of exploring the parameters of this dialogue just briefly here with the committee. Okay, you've explained to me why you think people might be have a difference in sympathies, but tell me, if you're the individual owning the piece of property, why you should be treated any differently if it's a limitation on your ability to build a house vis-a-vis your ability to actually potentially put several houses on that property that you own. I mean, tell me why we would want to treat those people differently in a compensation methodology.
Because, one, you have limited money. You're not going to have money to pay everyone for everything. So I think you have to set priorities. You've recognized that implicitly in the bill. And it's a higher priority for people not being able to build something they were going to use themselves. Second thing is, let's remember the 1980s. A lot of people who developed subdivisions went bankrupt. Those are speculative profits. It's one thing to say, well, it doesn't matter what the house is worth because I'm going to use it. It's another thing to say, oh, I counted on really cleaning up with the subdivision in 1980 or 1981. And I think that seems a lot more speculative. So the prospect, I mean, that's the fundamental difference.
Okay, so let me back up then and try this. Assuming sort of a perfect economic model where it factored in both the speculative nature, recognizing that not every piece of property that was zoned could have ever been developed because the market wouldn't recognize that, wouldn't allow for that. Not every piece of farmland was likely going to be a subdivision. But assuming that you had the ability from a model to do that, and you had the ability to establish the impact of the fair market value impact, why wouldn't those people, you know, in that economic environment be entitled to compensation just like the homeowner?
Well, if we were able, Mr. Chairman, to do that kind of modeling, and we are hypothecating at this point, right? I'd also want to include the givings in that case too, because there are a lot of things that created value for the development, access by roads primarily. I'm talking about rural lands as well, proximity to areas where employment is growing and so on, and I think we'd have to include all those factors. But it takes me back to a point, not about a theory of compensation or fairness, but simplicity in your legislative task. You have to keep it pretty simple. There isn't going to be unlimited money. You're going to have to set priorities. I think you'd find people clearly believe the highest priority would be, on a basis of fairness, paying people for something that they couldn't do for themselves, as opposed to a business proposition which involves risk, which is what the subdivision of development would be. Lost profits that may or may not. Yes, you could go back and model those, but then we're talking about a very complicated bit of legislation. So I can travel down that road a certain distance, but then I have to come back to it being May 15th and trying to do something that's pretty clear and direct.
Well, Mr. Liberty, I know one is more aware of the challenges from a practical standpoint that this bill faces.
I certainly can see that.
Even in the simplest context, this bill will remain complicated. But I guess I was interested in sort of the philosophical underpinning of your position that anyone who had any property that would have been other than single-family home, in other words, any kind of property that might have otherwise been developed for something else, you don't believe worthy of being included in compensation. And I think what I got you to agree to, and you can disagree with me if my characterization of your comments is wrong, that assuming that the economic model contained sufficient information to appropriately value and assess the risks that those people would have resulted in, and to really capture whether or not there was a fair market value difference, you don't have a philosophical objection to that kind of payment. You have a lot of practical objections.
No, I think it's more than that. I think there is a philosophical difference between paying people for not having their own home and paying people for lost business profits that were highly contingent, especially at the time we're talking about in the 70s and 80s. I don't think those are the same thing. It's their use of their own property as opposed to development someone else's use, the property.
So the government can take one, but it shouldn't take the other.
No, I'm not going to accept that kind of framing of the issue. I think the point is that people feel concern about fairness. They feel about people caught in the transition with fairness. And I think their sympathy is strongest for logical and appropriate reasons with people who couldn't build a house. After that, we're talking about taxing people to pay other people, and they begin to question, now, I'm involved in another business, and regulations changed, and I'm not paid. Why is that? That's philosophically different. It's not just a difference in degree, because we're not talking about compensating people generally for reductions in value of anything caused by government. People's stock portfolio is affected by changes in government regulations, but no one says, oop, there's a reduction in value, we need to be paying them. And I think that's more like a change in stock value as opposed to the opportunity to use the property for themselves, for their own home. So I do think there's a fundamental philosophical difference.
I'm always nervous when you start getting out to new ideas. I don't want you to give those people any more ideas about what they might include in the next ballot measure, Mr. Liberty. Well, an interesting dialogue. It's one that I think we're going to have again before we're done here. But I'd like you to continue with your testimony.
Okay. Thank you. The second major point is, and something we've already engaged in a little bit, which is the appraisal theory. Just saying fair market value, arm's length transaction, doesn't answer the most basic questions. This came up with the research done into the fiscal impact of Measure 7, which is you had to have a theory of appraisal in order to determine the financial impact. You're going to be looking at a funding mechanism. You have to have some idea about, and you've already done some research, I understand, and looking at potential claims. But the size of the claims and therefore how far the pool can be spread depends on your appraisal theory. This is not my field. Representative Beck knows a lot more about this, so forgive me if I'm not approaching it with the proper professional training. But here's one approach. You say, let's figure out what a rural home site is worth in Clackamas County in a RR5, rural residential 5-acre zone, and we attribute that value, today's value, to a lost opportunity to build a home in 1975 or 73 when Senate Bill 101 was passed in farm zones. That is going to be a much higher value for a variety of reasons than actually, I suspect, than going back and figure out what happened in 1973 as best we can judge before and after the regulation was adopted. That's the actual reduction in value, was that if there was an appraiser then who said the day after Senate Bill 101 went into effect, what happened to the value? Yes, I realize there'll be issues and arguments about what do we do about inflation. You have to think about that as fairness. What about interest? Okay. But that, I suspect, is a very different value than taking a 5-acre home site today in Clackamas County and attributing that amount of money to a lost opportunity in 1973 or 75. There's another part to this, which is if you look at land price curves, the price per acre goes up as parcel size decreases. This is not a Willamette Valley phenomenon because I first saw a good graph of this from Umatilla County. Why is that? Because you enter a different market when your parcel size shrinks. Regardless of what the regulations and law say, people see these as home sites. So the opportunity to build a house on a 120-acre parcel is not the same as the opportunity and the value afterwards of building a house on a 5-acre parcel because the markets are very different. There are very few people in the market for 120-acre home sites. There's a lot of people in the market for 5-acre home sites. So we are urging you to actually look at what it would have been, and there is a competing consideration about simplicity, but look at what it would have been at the time, make adjustments as necessary, and not kind of extract some value based on today. Another element about this is development patterns in 2001 are very different than what they were at 75 or 75, 73, and areas that are very hot commodities now, like within the commuter shed of Bend, had very low value then. People were not in the market even for, I think, 10 or 20 acre lots in Cook County, not to the degree they are today. I mean, there's a huge difference today. So we'd say if your idea is, going back to your point, what was the actual effect on value, you need to go back and try and establish that. Having said that, I understand that there's a competing consideration about simplicity. And the approach laid out tentatively in the bill is saying, or there's a fast track, which is simplified, where you could do some prior work and just say, well, we're going to kind of simplify this and here's the amount. I think that makes sense, too, both from the perspective of the claimants and being economical in the administrative costs for this legislation. Third point, the penalty for delay, if the government doesn't make the payment within the year, remedy is to build a house. We have very serious concerns about that. Generally, I understand that the people who have different perspectives on these issues are skeptical about whether government will follow through. We understand that. Don't share the skepticism, but understand that there is such skepticism. But the problem from our perspective is we also have skepticism. We have skepticism about whether government in the long term is as committed to the land base as it is to conserving money, and that it may be a very simple thing to say, let's just not pay the money and let the land development occur. Maybe it's not a universal proposition, but I suspect that many people believe government is more concerned about conserving its money than about conserving land. If you want to add a penalty on attorney fees and a penalty, that is more appealing to us than the idea of development. The Conservation or the Oregon Community Protection Coalition has said as one of its fundamental principles in legislation is no waivers, no rollbacks for existing regulations, and that's what this would be. Finally, last comment with regard to the retrospective piece, and these are not the sum total but the major points, is the idea of transferable development credits landing on rural land. Seems like this is an opportunity to create destination resorts. This legislative body has struggled long and hard over this, both with regard to particular proposed resorts and the whole policy issue as well. I hate to see this become another opportunity. I think there would be a lot of explaining that would have to be done to the public to explain why the development of a destination resort is part of legislation designed to pay people for not being able to build a house on farmland. It's a long stretch. Now, Mr. Chairman, if you'll indulge me, two comments I believe not covered by my colleague, Mr. Tucker, last week about the prospective piece. Is that acceptable, or I know your time is limited? What's your preference?
No, please go ahead.
Okay. The first has to do with the administrative system. I'm grateful for this flowchart, although I had to put on my glasses.
So did
any,
we.
I think any system that is inherently complicated has many levels of review, disadvantages individuals and governments that do not have money or resources. So something that's pretty complicated has multiple parts, opportunities for appeal, you have to use dueling appraisals, will be something that can be approached with some confidence by landowners who have money and by governments that have staff, GIS systems, lawyers. Most local governments in Oregon don't have those things. A very large part of the state is not covered by a GIS system that's tied into things like the property tax assessment system. Simplicity, on the other hand, makes it more accessible to the property owner applicant and at the same time reduces cost and therefore reduces inhibitions for local governments. If you're to use an example often used by my colleague, Mr. Chandler, Culver, you may never get around to adopting the regulation in the first place because you can't imagine doing the analysis to determine whether or not you would be liable or there would be a variance. You don't have a GIS system. You don't have the staff. You just don't adopt the regulation at all. Well, I understand some people may prefer that outcome, but it seems like it would be better to have a friendlier system with some staffing by this entity, the authority, that can help individuals seeking claim and help local governments who are trying to determine whether or not their regulation will cross the threshold and for how many properties. That's something that means that we would have a system a little more accessible to claimants, I believe, a little less intimidating and inhibiting to smaller governments. As part of that, I think you could, and I don't want to be stuck with this position forever, but thinking out loud, I imagine a much simpler system. You could even allow local governments to say, you know what, we don't even want to have to hear the appeals on this. We'd like your advice ahead of time whether or not our regulation will trip the wire, if you can give us some help on that, you know, staff of the authority. Secondly, if we adopt the regulation and people say, you know, that's over 25%, we would like to have the option of telling them to go directly to the authority and maybe we can show up and participate there. I'm trying to be clear about this. In other words, not have any local process at all. Go straight to this entity. Let their staff, yes, it will be more expensive there, but it may be cheaper overall. plus that authority develops some expertise in evaluating regulations and so on. It doesn't have to be mandatory. The City of Portland or Metro may decide, no, we'd like to review it here. But at least it reduces the inhibition for local governments and I think is friendlier for people who can't afford, if they want to make a claim, to pay an appraiser. Second point on prospective, and has to do with the statute of limitations, or period during which claims could be made. I'm not sure statute of limitations is the right terminology. I can't say that I fully understand this, so I'm not sure about all the limitations, but it seems to me from a system perspective, you would want a simple approach, which is for anything in which notice is provided, which covers a much broader spectrum than rezonings, for example, that you have a short period in which people can file their claims upon adoption, or if you want to trigger earlier notice, however you wish to do that, that they have a short period because they've received notice. If it was something like an interpretation where there wasn't notice provided, then give them a longer amount of time to discover it over the course of events. But the way I read the current draft of the bill is someone can come in to make a claim, you know, 20 years in the future, and then raise this issue. And that doesn't seem appropriate. I think at some point the governments are entitled to know that with regard to Regulation X, the period's expired, we don't have to worry about variances or claims. Finally, a very broad philosophical point, and it's been prompted by comments of John Echevarria, who spoke here last week and has followed this debate nationally for 10 or 15 years. He said, the people to which you ought to be directing your attention, who's talking to us, are the people who are caught in a transition from one system to another. These are the people usually used as examples of problems in the system, because they made assumptions based on how land use regulation occurred, and then there was a significant change, and they felt consequences of that change. So focusing on the transition is important in Mr. Echevarria's mind. But the counterpart to that is, he said, the idea that people in Oregon are not aware that government regulations may reduce value after you've had 25 years of discussion and debate about land use, he said, I question that. And the idea that you're going to create entitlements to payments for this is effectively restarting the clock, recalibrating people's expectations. If given the regulatory tradition in Oregon, which has been more aggressive because of greater concerns about quality of life and development patterns, we now have 25 years of it, that has formed people's expectations. Should we be changing those again? Is that what it's about, or should we be focusing on the people caught in the transition?
Thank you, Mr. Liberty. Are there questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
I would just sort of make one comment. I think this whole is the appraisal process is really ultimately would be a critical part of anything we do. And the more vague we leave it, the more problems we'll have between agencies and landowners. And if we go down the path of legislation, I think it's going to be really important to be as prescriptive as possible in terms of letting appraisers know how properties under this process would be appraised. And I think Mr. Liberty raised, you know, talked about some of his concerns about whether you take the zoning as it would have been and apply today's market. That is what they do in the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Area when the federal government acquires property. It's exactly what they do. It has been somewhat, even that has created some problems because it's not clearly written in law as to why and how to do that. But the other choice is to go backwards and take the zoning back then and what the market might have been, if you can ever figure that out, and apply a growth factor somehow. You can get really complicated and theoretical, which the appraisal process is anyway, inherently. So I just that's just one comment that I have after listening that, and looking through this draft a little bit. I think that without more prescriptive, I think it's a discussion the committee ought to have at some point, is how prescriptive we want to be to the appraisal process to avoid the source of train wrecks, inevitable train wrecks over disputes of value. And you're going to have it anyway. There's no way you can make the appraisal process totally fair. But to the extent we can hone in and define it, everybody will be better served.
Thank you, Representative Beck. Any other discussion?
Yes, Representative Schrader. Just a comment here. I think somewhat similar concerns that have been evinced by Mr. Liberty on the build-out of this thing. And one of the things this committee really has to grapple with is the amount of money that we're going to have available, who their priorities are. I'm not particularly keen on the priorities as presented in the draft here, but I think we need to come to grips with that. Those priorities will depend on how we approach this. And there's been several different models proposed, I think, in terms of discussions where I do have a philosophical opinion about who deserves to be compensated. And to me, that's the people prior to 1975. After that, my sympathy drops off somewhat dramatically based on the fact that, quite frankly, we've had several battles over this issue and they lost. The argument can be made, well, they won this battle here. And I think that's why we need to address the issue. I would hope we discuss the priorities at some point in time, and a little, you know, as we get more feedback from different groups, and I'm open to everybody out there. I'd like to know, and we're going to be doing this, how much money we're going to be trying to allocate, and is this a constant source of money or for a short period of time? Who are we compensating? Who are we helping compensate? I think the chair has wrestled with this, and I have. I think members of the committee, we talk about the local governments or the state, or both. And do we do prospective, any money there for the prospective piece at all? Comment that was, I think, hinted at here is we don't want the local governments to think there's an ongoing source of money they can buy their way out of having to, you know, do what they should be doing, which is thoughtfully establishing regulations that fairly treat people and don't burden them and yet allow for that growth in the community that we need to have. So I'm sensitive to some of these issues. I appreciate Mr. Liberty and Thousand Friends coming forward, and at least we're willing to talk about these, and we're starting, I think, finally get the type of input we need to have to round out our discussions, and then this committee is going to have one heck of a couple of sessions to go through to discuss this stuff and find out where we can come down.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate description. Anybody else have questions for Mr. Liberty or any other comments they want to make?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, one other thing, sort of generally, if we were opposed to you producing a bill, I wouldn't be here today. If I thought, given your starting point, it was impossible to produce a bill, I wouldn't be here today. We don't think that. We think it is possible. We would like to help you try and address it. Some of the things I've suggested, I hope people are not so skeptical they can't see that it benefits all parties and are willing to work with you and other committee members to do those things.
And I appreciate you making that comment. Obviously, if I thought it was impossible to produce a bill, I wouldn't be here either today. I still believe that we have the opportunity to do that, although the clock is ticking, and that's why we're moving in, I think, to the more serious conversations that we're starting to have about how do we make this work and getting these LC drafts out for people to look at and having regular meetings now where people can digest it. And I recognize that you can't look at this thing in an afternoon and be ready to talk about it at 3:30 and start offering a full scope of comments, neither can I. And that's why we're going to just start meeting regularly and having these broad discussions about and trying to figure out where people are going to high center if there's a way to work around it. So that's what we're about. None of it's predestined by any stretch of the imagination, and we want everybody who's got an opinion to share it with the committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do you have a comment, Representative Lowe, you wanted to make?
No, you pretty much covered it.
Oh, all right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Liberty. Cliff Kanagi, I have signed up. Welcome, Mr. Carnegie.
Thank you. I promise this to be the shortest testimony of the afternoon. I usually introduce myself as a farmer. Today, I am Cliff Carnegie, a broken record. I am submitting the same testimony that I did several weeks ago, but with one change. It is on more brightly colored paper in the hope that it will be less likely to become lost in the process. I will read only 36-word quote from Russell Sadler's commentary. If property owners want cash when land use restrictions reduce the value of their property, then it is only fair that property owners cough up some cash from the increased market value created by public improvements. Thank you for this opportunity to speak on the issue.
Before you leave, Mr. Carnegie, I just want to find out if anybody's got any questions they want to ask you.
Appreciate the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Carnegie.
Thank you.
I appreciate the pink.
Yeah, I do too. Well, I just think it's not only the shortest, but it's the most humorous testimony I've heard today, Mr. Carnegie, and I could use it, so I appreciate that. There is no one else signed up. I will throw open the door for anyone else who wants to come forward at this point to comment on the current version of LC 4258, either on the prospective or the retroactive part of the bill. Is there anybody who wants to bring forward any of their comments now, recognizing that some people only today have seen the retroactive comments for the first time? Right. The council reminds me that essentially the piece that you're seeing today and the retroactive piece is essentially just the codification of that the bullet point analysis of the rural piece that was shared with the committee and folks last week. Mr. Witte, you have come forward. You have dared to venture into the lion's mouth.
Yes, I have, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Jim Witte representing the Oregon Environmental Council. And I don't have any specifics on the language today. I want to support Mr. Liberty's comments. But I wanted the committee to understand that the Oregon Environmental Council also wants to see legislation, replacement legislation for Measure 7 passed this session, and that we're here to work with any party and all the members of the committee to make sure that happens. That'll do it.
Any questions for Mr. Witte? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Schrader.
Yeah, just a comment. I'm trying to get our hands around the parcel piece a little bit, and I didn't know if there's any feedback we needed to receive at this time on that, and I wanted to make sure that either at the hearing here or afterwards we communicated with the group again to line out where we're going with trying to go figure something statewide. That's very difficult. They did a great job. The map guys did a great job, but it's time now to extrapolate that somehow, some way statewide. I've had some conversations with various parties, and then also some discussion here recently about the difficulty of trying to get zone information on top of that, almost impossible. And one of the things I was throwing out, just so all the committee knows, is maybe trying to identify a specific subset, like pick a date, 75, 85, maybe 85, because there's better data at the county level for that, and work on, say, the lot of record aspect, come up with some more defined universe, and then we can at least see one subset of information that we've asked for, and that might be a little more doable than the Herculean task we've asked them. Then once we see that, they may find a way to extrapolate that, or we may say, fine, that gives us something to go on and go from there. I'm just trying to get our hands around it.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good idea. I know Mr. Cooper, who I don't see in the room, but he was here earlier today, had indicated that he is happy, and the gentleman who made the presentation last week are essentially waiting for us to line out in a little more detail what the next level of information we are asking them to produce. So to the extent any of you have questions or you would like to try to see that data broken down in another way, I can't promise you that they've got the resources or the information to do it, but it doesn't hurt to ask, and they can give us their best guesstimate on some of that as to how that data breaks down or whether they can or they can't accomplish it. So I guess what I'd ask you to do, so we route this all in a convenient way, is communicate with Ginny any of your questions you've got about the parcelization and the information that was from the map vote that were presented last week, and she'll make a formal request to Mr. Cooper, and they'll come back down and talk to us as soon as they get the data put together.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. I would substantially narrow the universe of parcels from that which has been presented already based on some different criteria, and are you open to a discussion about...
Well, why don't we, if you want to see what the data would produce, I'm happy to feel free to communicate with Ginny, and they can see whether or not it's an ability to crunch the numbers. Remember that even they were of the opinion that the data was good for trend purposes,
but not
much beyond that. And that's important for us to acknowledge. I mean, it's the best data we're going to probably get our hands on, and so to the extent you want to see how it trends differently based on different criteria, I think that's worthy. But I think we got to remember that it's trending data primarily, and that's what it is. Representative Beth?
I had a question, and it's probably for staff as much, or maybe Representative Schrader or someone in the audience, but I'd kind of like to have a little discussion about the benchmarks that we could draw the line at in terms of who would qualify and what those benchmarks mean. The Senate Bill 100 was signed in 1973, and you just threw out we could apply this to anybody who's owned property before 1975. And I'd kind of like to know what the rationale for doing that would be versus whenever the next big change in the land use system was, which was 1980-something, or adoption. Maybe the one threshold is if you own property at the time your county's comprehensive plan was adopted, so it would vary from each county.
Right.
And then whenever the next big or major group of statutory changes were made that had statewide effect, and then I guess 93 was the last time. I've had some informal conversations with Kurt and maybe people in the audience, but I'd be worth going over that for me to so we can start choosing or being able, not choosing, but try to assess where the right place would be to draw this line, because that's going to drive those trends on those maps are going to be driven by that. And if, for the sake of keeping this as simple as possible so that landowners feel like they're not getting thrown into a huge bureaucracy, we might decide to just say if you had property prior to the adoption of your comp plan, you can be a part of this. If not, the committee should have that discussion, that we need to make that choice at some point in this process.
Well, and I'm hopeful that in Thursday's meeting, now that people have seen the draft LC language sort of more than just a concept piece, will come forward and present some comment about, I think different groups have a different opinion as to where that line ought to be drawn. And I think it would be helpful for the committee to have some testimony from folks about where they think that line ought to be. Similarly, it's probably helpful for us as a committee to discuss at some point what our own analysis is as individual committee members about, at what point do you justify letting somebody in to the compensation scheme, and then if the answer is everybody all the time, then the question is how do you, if you assume a limited source of revenues, how do you assume then the priority in which you would pay people? And I mean, those are the issues that I think we've got to have, and I'm hopeful that we're in a position to sort of really vet that conversation out more fully on Thursday. I will tell you that I've asked on the 24th per sort of our tentative calendar of issues to address, so a week from this Thursday, Paul Warner, the Legislative Revenue Officer, will come in and make a presentation essentially just about a myriad of potential funding sources that one could talk about and discuss the various impacts, responses, the proximity of nexus to the issue, and is just going to lay those out essentially on the table. So a good chunk of the meeting on the 24th, I think, will be talking about what those results might prove. And so that's what we're going to do on the 24th. I'm hoping by the end of this week, and I will tell folks that, you know, it would be nice for us to, and I know this is probably asking too much, but on the 17th to have gotten everybody's comments on the prospective piece and to start sort of wrapping that up. And one of the big issues there is the issue of threshold, and I'm hoping that we can have a full discussion in Thursday's committee about the proper placement of the threshold issue for when somebody going forward triggers their right to compensation. And so my hope is we'll have that conversation on Thursday. We'll also talk about the process. The process piece is out there and is a little more readily available. I'd like us to bring us to some conclusion on that. And I'm pushing back the introduction of the constitutional language piece to probably Tuesday the 22nd, so a week from today. We'll have a conversation and have some draft constitutional language out and available for people to start to discuss as of next Tuesday. So that's the, I mean, it's a, it, you know, we're going to have to work through the agenda fairly quickly if we intend to get anything done. Representative Beck.
Something that might be helpful if Ginny could do this is maybe a list of 36, when each county adopted their comp plan. Just that would be one benchmark. And then whatever the next benchmark would be, I think 1984 was, or 80.
That'd be about the time that the comp plans were adopted.
We're all,
the last, adopted, you know, they were all adopted, I think, by 1985.
Okay.
So between 75 and 85 is when the comp plans
were. Okay, well, I'd be curious to see sort of how that breaks down. And then also in 93 has been another time frame people talk about. But also in 93, what changes were made that would impact your property?
Right.
The income test, minimum lot size has changed. If I could get some context analysis.
An outline of 3661.
Yeah, and right. But there was, it seemed to me there was another time frame. I guess the three were Senate Bill 100, comp plans, and then 93.
Right. Mm-hmm. Representative Close.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You have a 20-page draft here. You have 22 sections. I request that at some point we have somebody from Legislative Council walk us through these sections, tell us what each section does so that we understand this thoroughly.
We can do that, Representative Close.
Thank you.
Thursday?
Yes.
Yeah, we can do that on Thursday.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Okay, thank you. We will adjourn.